Hey everybody, this is Tim Chavez from Faith Matters. Today's episode was with an incredible Latter-day Saint poet, Darlene Young. Darlene has just released a new book of poetry called Here, which was published by BCC Press. It's an honest, vulnerable, relatable, and incredibly approachable book that we laughed and cried our way through. In our conversation with Darlene, she talked about the value of poetry itself, how it can be a dance to prose's walk, help us to see life as more abundant, and show the moments we might see as mundane in a more poignant and meaningful light. Darlene also reminded us that in order for art to really affect us, it has to tell the truth. Telling the truth is the beginning of healing, and we've rarely encountered Latter-day Saint poetry that does this as well as Darlene's. And knowing that we'd be releasing this episode on Mother's Day weekend, we also talked with Darlene about her poetry that speaks to the struggles and beauties of motherhood, parenting, and the bittersweetness of it all. Her poetry really does have a way of giving life to feelings that for many of us may have previously been somewhat indescribable. In the end, it seemed like bittersweet was the word that we kept coming back to when we talked with Darlene and encountered her work. It doesn't shy away from the difficult, the annoying, or the tedious aspects of our lives, but in a really beautiful way, as faith at its best does, it paints them as part of a fuller picture of beauty and purpose. Darlene received her BA and MFA from BYU, and has taught English and writing as adjunct faculty there. So if you want to pick up Darlene's book, again, it's called Here, and was published by BCC Press. You can pick it up now on Amazon. Thanks, as always, for listening, and with that, we'll jump right into the conversation.
Darlene, thank you so much for being here. We are serious fans of yours, so we're really excited to have you in the studio.
I'm a fan of yours, too.
Oh,
I'm so happy to be here.
Oh, we've been really looking forward to this. I'd love to just start and hear a little bit about your background. We're really familiar with your poetry and some of your writing, but could you just talk about growing up and like how you started writing? Were you always a writer? Were you writing poetry as a child? And how did it all start?
When I was a kid, my mom wrote poetry. And I want to pause for a second and say there's a difference between poetry and verse. Mm. Like verse, I would call verses just things that rhyme, the end of the rhyme, and it's got a regular rhyme scheme. So like Dr. Seuss would be verse. And some verse is also poetry. And some poetry is also verse. So my mom wrote a lot of verse. I wouldn't say she wrote poetry. And she encouraged me to do so too. And so I would enter the elementary school reflections contest.
Did you have that? Yes.
And I would always win because I could rhyme. And I would literally sit there and go, okay, what rhymes with snow? Bo, co, lo. You know, and then I just write to that. And
that's amazing.
That can get you only so far though. Because by the time I hit, especially high school, probably junior high, I came in contact with real poetry. And I was like, oh, that's not what I
do. Mm-hmm.
And I just quit completely. Didn't write anymore after that. It wasn't until I was a young mom. My husband was in grad school and we were living in Berkeley. And I had an experience. And I also had a really cool community of friends who were really smart. And I wanted to write it. And I wanted it to be in a poem. I wanted it to have a certain kind of impact. And I just challenged myself. I'm gonna go back to poetry. I had read poetry all along, good stuff. I think that's important to be reading it. So I wrote that and I sent it off and it got published in this little newsletter that Orson Scott Card used to put out called Vigor. Then I finally took a class, independent study from BYU, and eventually went back, got my master's degree in creative writing at BYU. So doing it a little more seriously now.
Yeah. I'll say. So I love imagining middle school, you discovering that what you've been doing is not poetry. But I think a lot of people actually probably really resonate with that moment of just realizing like poetry is out of reach. This is hard. And then you're kind of made to try to appreciate it. And I wonder if that's kind of the end point for a lot of people when it comes to their interactions with poetry.
Yeah, I think so. They like the stuff that rhymes and it's kind of cool to hear it over the pulpit once in a while, you know. President Monson and his little rhyming poems.
Yes.
And sometimes when something rhymes, it sticks in your head better and you think, oh, that's cool. It makes you remember it. But when you read what people are calling poetry, you know, like with a capital P and a British accent, sometimes it's hard. Like the language is hard to get into and you think there's something going on here that I'm supposed to pick up on and I'm not picking up on it. Mm-hmm. And they say, this isn't worth the trouble. Like I can just go read this in prose and I don't need to spend the time on this. And I think it's important to remember there's like this continuum. I call it the accessibility continuum. Some poems are really dense and hard to understand. Some feel like it's just a paragraph that someone broke up into lines, you know, and they may or may not make it rhyme. And different people have different tastes along here. And I think it's okay if you just decide, you know, I just don't like the stuff that makes me work really hard. And I want to understand it more quickly. I like this better. And then everybody might prefer more or less play with language, for example. And so one of my favorite metaphors for poetry versus prose is poetry is to prose as dancing is to walking. Oh, so wow. If you think, if I'm really hungry and the vending machine's over there, I'm going to trot myself over there as quick as I can. And this metaphor, the vending machine, is meaning that the author wants to share with us, right? So prose is you trot right over. Poetry is like, I might dance on the way. Yeah. And so I might take a little more time to get over there. And with some poets, maybe we won't even get there at all, but didn't we have a good time on the way? And so if you just decide some poets don't really care whether I get that meaning and it doesn't matter if I don't, I'm just going to enjoy the language. Mm. That's a denser poem and you're dancing more. And that may be what you like or it may not be.
Yeah.
So I want to take away that fear, like I have to get it.
So let me ask, I guess this is the utilitarian in me coming out a little bit, but then what's the purpose? Is it just poetry can be more enjoyable just as in dancing could be more enjoyable than walking, or what else does poetry bring to the world that prose or other, you know, forms of literature can't?
Right. That's such a good question. So for me, I think about that scripture that Jesus says, I'm come that you might have life and more abundantly. Mm. So a poem to me helps me have life more abundantly because what it does is it draws my attention to the details of life. Like it helps me fall in love with the details of the world. And it helps me, like if I frame an experience, say I take my son to get his wisdom teeth out, and then I make myself frame it into a poem, it makes me kind of relive and deepen and reengage. It like makes that moment more poignant kind of in retrospect.
Yeah.
And as I go out in the world and try to notice poems around me, like I'm living my life more abundantly. It's deeper and I'm paying more attention to the details. And then also it's a common saying among poets, the goal is to make it strange. And that means I'm going to describe an experience, but I'm going to describe it in a way you've never heard it described before. I might use weird metaphors that surprise you or other ways to make your brain go, whoo. And that's because when you see something afresh with new eyes, you can appreciate it in a different way.
I love that so much. I have totally had that experience with your poetry. And in fact, the thing that's coming to mind is from Homespun and Angel Feathers, where, and I can't remember which poem it is even, but it stayed with me where you talk about the backseat is like a scrapbook and looking through your rearview mirror, you're seeing your kids grow through all these ages. They're in car seats and they're teenagers looking out the window. And I feel like you gave me access to something that was so deeply true and just mundane, but I'd never held on to that before until you expressed it in this beautiful artistic way. And I think that had you lectured me about, like, don't take these moments for granted and notice how you've been driving the same car and your kids are growing through the, you know, like that would have meant nothing to me. It doesn't access like the emotion of how that actually feels to be watching your children like grow up and out. And so I appreciate that it sort of opens up this portal to being able to recognize something that is really true.
Yeah. I think what you're talking about is the specificness of concrete details. That's another thing that good poetry uses. When someone says to you, oh, enjoy these moments.
Yes.
That's so vague and abstract. And you're like,
it means nothing.
What does that look like? It doesn't even touch ground for me. But a good poem, and there's bad poem. Like, here's an example. I can read this because I produced this on AI yesterday. Yes. Love is like a rose. It blooms and grows. Its beauty is divine. Its feeling is so sublime. Love is like a song. It can make you feel strong. It can take away the pain and leave you feeling sane. Okay. So all these words like strong and divine and sane, like these are so abstract.
Yeah.
And I wouldn't say that if one of my students wrote a poem like that, I wouldn't say, I don't believe you don't feel pain or love, but I would say, what does that look like? Where does it hit ground for you?
Yeah.
And so, and if you can get those concrete specific details, it's what happens when you are parked at a stoplight and you look in the rearview mirror and you see your kid asleep or whatever the thing is. That's a specific thing. Now we're having an artistic experience.
Yeah.
So, and if I can create that experience for you, I'm involving your body and your mind and you believe me and we have an empathy together.
Yes. Mm.
That's what I think good art does.
Yeah. That makes so much sense to me. And I had the same experience that Aubrey did reading your poetry. I felt like I was feeling nostalgic about your life. And then I was like, wait a second, like maybe I'm having the same types of moments that are just totally passing me by.
And even if I'm really super specific about what it's like to be an old middle-aged lady, which there's a lot of poems about that, right? But if I'm really specific about that, it can trigger something in your mind of, oh, I've felt something kind of like that before, even though you haven't been an old middle-aged lady so far.
Yeah,
right.
Right. No, I'm not.
Not yet.
But it was really, no, but honestly, it has made me sort of, it's almost like the world has slowed down a little bit for me. Whereas before, you know, at least in the moments that where I resonated with what you were writing, you know, like I was saying, like noticing something about your kids or about your, I mean, in my case, I have aged a little bit. And so when I noticed, you know, changes in my hair color or whatever, actually seeing that in a sort of new and less mundane and potentially more beautiful way, it's actually meant a lot to have that from you. So thank you.
And I was going to add, we've talked a lot about Jonathan Haidt's book, The Righteous Mind, and and this whole idea that you're kind of always you're kind of always in this intention with the elephant and the writer. So with like reason and with feeling, and that you think that you can present a logical argument and persuade someone to change their mind, but really it's you've got to speak to the emotion of whatever is their motivation, and then they find reason to justify
it.
And I think the other thing that poetry does for me is it sort of bypasses the writer. I don't feel defensive because it's heart to heart. And so you're just really open to having this empathy experience with the author. And I think that makes you more able to hear a new idea and sit with it because you recognize the same emotions in your own life.
Yeah.
And I would love to just skip ahead and do this. If you would do the Plan of Salvation reading, this is actually one of those poems that kind of did that. Like, I think had you given a talk in Sunday school, I might have felt some resistance to this idea, but this poem knocked me on the floor.
Okay.
So maybe that's a good place to start.
And I just want to acknowledge Arianta Magazine for being the first ones to publish this, which I really appreciate. Oh, okay. It's called A Plan of Salvation. She was born healthy and bright to the right family. No trauma, no drama. In a neighborhood healthy and bright, probably white. No trauma, no drama. Good clothes, good looks, good music and books. Fell in love not too soon. Lovely wedding, perfect groom, pleasant little honeymoon. Children came healthy and bright, only as often as the parents could afford. They played together, adored their mother and each other, grew up without trauma, married without drama to good people, raised right, a delight to their in-laws. And so it proceeded at just the right pace, well and right, until all that remained was retirement in a sunny place, not too far from the dear grandchildren, so sweet and polite, healthy and bright. A spot of golf, a cruise or two, and then she was through, dying pleasantly in her sleep. And then she dragged her milky, weak, underformed spirit limbs into the presence of her God and demanded her money back. Hell no, King Lucifer replied. You got everything right, just what you voted for. Sit, stay, fetch, good girl.
I don't know what I love most about that poem. I love the rhythm and I love the whiplash of the last stanza. And it made me laugh, but then I was instantly crying. And I couldn't even put my finger on why is this causing such a strong emotional reaction. And I think it was maybe just that you access something so true. My soul recognized. I think I want this no trauma, no drama life. That's what I'm always reaching for. It's not actually what I want.
No. Yeah. I don't think it's wrong of us to long for that. That's totally natural. I mean, everything in our biology is screaming, get me safe, you know, get me food.
Yeah. So why did you write this poem? What was sort of the process?
So I was thinking about, you know, how much time I spend in prayer and in thought and in stress trying to get rid of the hard things that hurt. Yeah. You know, I was trying to teach myself I can't expect this for my children who are young adults and starting to, you know, think about young adults as they just make bigger mistakes or their mistakes have more potential for long-term damage. And I have good kids, but you stress, the things you stress about get bigger. Sorry to tell you guys, the older the kids get. That's not the plan. Like, I am convinced that I signed up, I looked down at what the plan was going to be, and I said to God, I want the roller coaster. I don't want the gentle little love tunnel float around the It's a Small World ride, you know, with people singing. Like, I want the ups and downs, and I want the thing that will bring me to be like you. I'm sure that's what I chose. But when it gets down to what I'm praying for, it's like, take this away, make this easy for him, make this not hurt so much. And I give him my list, you know, and Just a little reminder.
That's what it looks like. Yeah. Oh, I love that. Was maybe my favorite of this book. I really love this one.
Yeah.
Maybe that brings us to this idea of cultural pain. And I wonder if you think that as a people, we kind of have, and maybe this is just human nature in general, but do we have this aversion to just acknowledging and accepting our pain? You know, I was thinking of the hymns we sing on Sunday and Should We Die, All Is Well, like happy day. You know, even like if the worst happens, we're trying to pump each other up, like, no, it's fine. Smile and have enough faith that you don't feel pain. And of course, that's not what we really mean, but I wonder if that's what it looks like when we show up on Sundays. And so I'd love for you to just talk about how do you think we could address this better? And maybe like what is poetry's role to play in that process?
Oh man, yeah, that's such a big question. I think we all sort of feel deep down that we're not really getting down to the meat of things. We're showing up and we're kind of gliding, skimming over the surface. And, you know, the poor person who has to give the lesson, she's going to ask the easy questions because heaven forbid someone raise their hand and go off. And it's just easier just to remind ourselves of all the answers that we all know and not a lot, you know. Mm-hmm. And once in a while, I get a few brave souls who raise their hands and talk about real pain in one of those meetings, and it's messy. We don't like mess. That makes us uncomfortable. I think in order for art to affect us at all, it has to tell the truth. So I want to tell the truth about my culture. I want to tell the truth about life. Life is messy. Faith is messy. And if I don't tell the truth, I can't touch anybody, right?
I was just going to ask. I mean, this is something I've been thinking about a little bit. Actually, your work makes it so obvious that pain is such an important part of this experience that we're all having. But there is a difference. I was thinking about this and I don't quite know what the answer is. It seems like there's a difference between good pain and bad pain. There's a difference between exercise where you're like, you're struggling and it's hard and it hurts, but you know that you're growing through something and it's going to be good. And just getting punched in the face, you know, where it's like, there's not really going to be any growth from that.
Right.
And it's just hard. And it doesn't really seem to be leading anywhere. Do you differentiate between types of pain, the type that you see as this roller coaster that's part of the plan and a part that really should be avoided and should be replaced with peace instead?
It's a really good question. First of all, a lot of times we can't see whether the pain was good or bad until later, yeah. Right? So, you know, we can look back and say, oh, it's a good thing I went through that because it led to this thing. And so I would hate to especially ever judge someone else's pain. But I think, I mean, I do get this idea of good and bad pain, or I like to think of it as clean and dirty pain. There's the pain of the thing that you can't avoid. And then there's the pain that you bring to it and to everything else by saying things should be different. Mm-hmm. And that's the dirty pain, I think. And we sometimes inflict dirty pain on each other at church by saying, you shouldn't be hurting. This should be easy. Because you believe in Jesus Christ, this should be easy, which is false doctrine. I think it's absolutely false doctrine. And I think that's what I was trying to get at in this poem, is we spout this to each other sometimes. And in parenting too, like you shouldn't hurt instead of being willing to sit with the pain. I was thinking about Thomas McConkie's interview with you guys about the role of, maybe this was during COVID.
Yeah.
You guys, if you remember this, but the role of pain and, was it, he used the word cook, maybe? Yeah. Cook us? Helping us become more pure, sanctifying us. Mm-hmm. But you have to be willing to sit with it and let it do its work and not say, my job is to just escape this at all costs.
Yeah.
So, I mean, we should avoid the dirty pain, which usually comes from judging ourselves and others for hurting.
Yeah.
And instead say, no, this is, I signed up for this.
So what do you imagine that actually looks like on a Sunday? How would you imagine we really validate that together in a community? Like, do you imagine hymns where we're just like, this is the hardest thing and there's no hope?
Yeah. Maybe it's Sunday isn't the place. I don't know. I'm thinking of my friend Gideon Burton, who wrote a hymn about what being with Christ while we watch our friends leave the church and our children and still loving them and having peace about it and trusting that he's got them too. And I think that is the coolest hymn ever, but it's not going to make it into the hymn book. Right. You know, I think there's priorities about what happens in our official meetings and stuff. And it may not, this kind of thing may not happen, but that's why we need art. That's why we need Faith Matters. That's why we need places where people can tell the truth to each other and sit with the pain and be honest about it.
Yeah.
So I don't think that you can feel testimony if you're also not being honest with yourself about the hard things too.
Yeah.
So in this particular poem, A Plan of Salvation, this the subject of the poem, it sounds like she had a, you know, pretty easy life. Not much was inflicted on mm-hmm. her. But what are the choices that she should have made that were different in terms of, you know, the things that she does have control right. over?
Well, mm-hmm. like, I don't think this woman is mythological.
Understood. Yes.
There's no one who has a life like this. So I didn't write this because I wanted to criticize any of her actions. She's not even active in this, which is part mm-hmm. of why yeah. she's Satan's child, because she's not active.
Wow.
But nothing bad happens to her. No one goes through life like this.
Oh, I see what you're saying.
So the point is that if we feel bad that our lives don't look like this, or if we think I'll feel better about the world and better with God or better whatever as soon as my mess gets cleaned up so that I yeah. look more like this, but that's unrealistic. Mm-hmm. Like, it's not going to. And if it did look like this, you wouldn't have gone through what you need to become like God.
Yeah.
Right.
Okay. So you're not, in this particular poem, you're not making an argument necessarily no. for being more adventurous or
not necessarily.
Daring.
I do not think anyone needs to go out purposefully yeah. looking for pain.
Yeah.
Like, it's going to find you.
Yeah. Yeah. That makes sense.
Maybe something that would be so valuable and that art can really influence is that we stop acting like we stop like holding that up as the ideal. And,
right.
and I think we do that totally unconsciously, but you kind of address one of these things that we do explicitly in the poem, The Truth Is. Can we do that reading too?
Sure. So I just, as many mothers do, I don't know about you, Aubrey, but I've always had a hard time with Mother's Day. So one Mother's Day when it came around, I was thinking, okay, what is it that drives me so crazy about this day? It's those talks you hear, the angel mom talks, mm-hmm. I call them, where people get up there and talk about my mother or my grandmother or someone was such an angel, and they tell you all these things. And they often say this phrase, which I hate, which is, she never complained.
Right.
And I don't believe it. I am sorry. I do not believe that person exists, that she never, ever complained. And if she does exist, I'm wondering what's wrong. Yeah. Right? So that's what this is about. It's called The Truth Is. One, she did complain, but her sweet children have chosen not to remember. They think this is a kindness. What does such an edit do to their own wives and daughters, to themselves? Two, she did complain, but they didn't notice. What they heard, some kind of disturbance in the distance. It made them vaguely uneasy, like when the sun goes behind a cloud. Three, she did complain, but, well, how does one define complain? They heard wishful thinking, daydreams, nothing real. Four, she did not complain. She didn't know she could. Five, she did not complain. It was a choice. Unbearable, the thought of herself as complainer. She'd heard the talks at church. Six, she did not complain. She had discovered its fruitlessness. Seven, she did not complain. Those around her would not allow it. How powerful their control, how beautiful their world. Eight, she did not complain. She had lost language completely in her terror. Was this to be her life? Nine, she did not complain, but kept it inside where it ate a hole through parts of her designed to protect her from herself. She went from doctor to doctor searching. 10, she did not complain. She had nothing to complain about. Every day was joyful, the only problems ones to which she had the answers or bottomless faith that she would soon. In fact, she's never left the garden at all. The adults around her find her amusing. 11, she did not complain, being silent like all mythical creatures.
I love that.
This is one of my meaner ones.
It was so great. It just, you instantly realize, like, of course, one of these alternatives is the truth. Of course, if you pause to think about it, but unexamined, it can be really a heavy burden because
yeah.
it's a heavy standard to hold yourself to. What if we just stop celebrating that idea because we can see that there's something yeah. broken there?
And I don't yeah. want to, like, I call it a mean poem. It makes me a little bit uncomfortable. And that's why it's good that a poem would come out in a collection. So
yes.
I have hopeful poems too.
Yes.
But I don't want to make light of someone's true feelings about his mother or grandmother. Someone who, and I say him, yeah. because I think it's guys who mostly do this. But, if he truly believes that she was a saint, that she never complained, I don't want to make light of that feeling. Who doesn't want to feel appreciated for something.
Yeah.
But I would want to ask him, what really is it? You know, what do you think? Do you think she nothing ever bothered her? Is that the virtuous thing you're praising? Or that nothing bothered her and she didn't say anything about it? And so are you saying none of us should either? Or, you know, I just want to, I'd want to ask what that is. And then also I want to model, here I am writing a complaining poem, right? But I want to model, I also, you know, really love the Lord and really have faith and hope in the world and read some of these other poems and and see you can hold the negative and the positive together.
Yes.
Which reminds me, sorry, let me tell you one more story.
Yeah.
About Mother's Day. So my poor children are the children of an English professor. And so one of the prices you pay is that she's critical about how you write. So you know those the Mother's Day letters or cards that say, oh, you're such a good mom, I love you. I don't go for those because I know they're not true, right? I'm not that great of a mom. I know they love me, but like I have actually required my children, it sounds awful. I have required my children, if you would like to write me a note, that's fine, but I want it to only talk about very specific things that I've done right. Wow. You know, and we in English, right, and in writing teaching, we talk about use concrete specific details, and they have to do that. So they can write me the letter that has concrete specific details about what I've done right, because I can't argue with that. If they say, you got up at this time every, you know, Tuesday and drove me to this and whatever, I can argue with that. Yeah, I did. Bring it on, right? And so I think it's the same with poetry, that if I tell the truth about the bad stuff, then you'll believe me when I tell the truth about the good stuff.
Yeah.
So if the next poem is saying praise God, then you maybe can believe that more, because I'm also saying life is hard sometimes in the church. Sometimes we screw stuff up, but I kind of like the church, you know, and so you can believe it more because I tell the truth about both.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes, definitely. And both of you, both of those types of poems sort of just, they encourage you to examine how you define saints, like how you define whatever you're aspiring to be. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a useful exercise that you sort of are doing unconsciously as you read. It just, it's challenging things that you've never thought about before that might be problematic.
Yeah. Do you want to do a, maybe go off script a little bit and do a hopeful poem?
Do a more
because hopeful. I'm looking at what's next and I'm like, okay, there's a couple more like tough ones.
Do you define Mother's Day in the spirit world as hopeful? Because that is probably my second favorite.
Yeah. I guess of the whole. That's more hopeful. Do I have that one here?
Let's do that.
Yes. Mother's Day in the spirit world. The men stay indoors. Is that the hopeful thing about it? That's probably the thing that makes it good. The men stay indoors. The women, all sisters, walk out of front doors and tell no one where they're going or when they'll be back. They join arms like Red Rover and sing, trilling fingers through everything. They eat chocolate, watch the kiss scene from a room with a view. They take naps under weeping willows. They visit their living. They stroke the hair of tired mothers and whisper, you make the sunrise. Look how everyone's eyes follow you. To those who want to be mothers, they whisper, you are enough. To those who don't want to be mothers, they whisper, you are a blessing to the universe. To old women, they say, you're beautiful and God can't wait to see you again. To young girls, they say, want the whole world and take it. They sprinkle laughter into dust devils and the ocean and all wind chimes and roller skates. They tickle babies. They tease out lilacs and waterfall spray. They tumble into thunder, bubble into plums.
Oh, thank you.
That's a cute little scene.
Yeah. It is. And I mean, my very favorite line is when they talk about they tell no one where they're going.
I know.
But I love the
Isn't
way.
That the picture of freedom? It's just being able, I'll be back later. See ya.
Yes. Slam. I just loved it. It made it feel like these mundane things that you may secretly be like hoping for. It you celebrated every single little thing. And like the trilling your fingers through everything they walk by. Like there really was, it just felt like a world full of delight. And I loved that every single tiny detail, you know, every single thing that a mom who's kind of in the thick of it might hope for was like celebrated. And I loved, like, it could be that small and that joyful. And I loved imagining, like, this is what our mothers would come back to tell us, you know, on Mother's Day. So that was, one of my very favorites.
Yeah. We had an interview with Susan Cain a few months ago, who recently wrote a book called Bittersweet. And she sort of made the argument that artists often do their best work in the bittersweet moments of their lives. And I think I think she's, you know, fairly specific that it's not just the bitter moments, you know, but it's those sort of like moments of melancholy where you simultaneously recognize that, that something bigger and more awe-inspiring potentially is going on at another level behind the pain. Mm-hmm. Is that, does that resonate with you? Yeah. Is, as that, has that, yeah, been your experience?
And that's such a great place for a poem. It's just, because that's where we feel human, right? If you think about it, like animals, either daddy's got a dog biscuit and life is all great, or I'm miserable. And there's not really that. I think it's, it to me, when I feel those moments, it's like, that's when I'm reminded I'm a daughter of God. Like, yeah, I have this inheritance of a different kind of spirit than animals and plants, where I can hold pain and joy at the same time. And I can almost even take a little joy in the melancholy of it, right? Mm-hmm. I can almost relish it a little bit because it tells me I'm human, I'm alive, I'm having this experience.
Yes. Yeah. Oh, I really love that. We had a listener actually reach out who is an artist, and I think his name is Owen Mortensen, and I will have to double check that. Actually, let me just check really fast because it'd be way easier to edit it in right now.
That's true.
But he did, he's doing the cool, yeah, Owen, okay. Owen Mortensen. And he's doing, he mentioned that he's working on this series of progression. And I was looking at some of his work, and he has things like a banana that's photographed at each stage of its, like, rot, I guess. Like, it's ripe, uh-huh, and it's green, and then it's brilliant yellow, and then it all the way to when it's just like black and black, black. Mm-hmm. And then same thing, he has a fan of leaves that are like vibrant green, and then goes through all of the colors of autumn, yellow, mm-hmm, and orange and red. And then eventually it's just like this decayed skeleton. And I had just finished your book, and I felt like that this art was giving me the same feeling that I had about so many of your poems, where like there is something really beautiful about this like very natural thing that is happening in our lives. Like we're aging, like we're following the same pattern of these rotting bananas, you know, like slowly. But like there's something also so beautiful about every, yeah, single stage, like fulfilling that stage's measure in, you know, completely. And I feel like when I'm in my reasoning, logical brain, it's really hard to feel that way. It just, mm-hmm, feels like I'm losing myself when I'm like at my best. Like my, mm-hmm, the yellow banana like is never gonna be as good as when it's in that third stage, you know? Right. And I feel like the poetry and these images just made it feel like the entire process is something to be, mm-hmm, celebrated and loved at every single stage. And I think that is the bitter sweetness of life. Like, yeah, it really is a mesh of both things. Like there's something really joyful about those last stages where like it's getting very brown and or black, and like where the fruit is rotting away. And also that's exactly what it should look like in that stage. And I felt like that was the lesson that just kind of kept being revealed. Like there's something so beautiful here, and it's not something to be resisted. It's just, mm-hmm, we can totally embrace these moments where you feel kind of both, yeah, both things, the joy and the pain.
And yeah, describing that art reminds me of the concept of memento mori, which is like, yes, you know, in art and in other ways, reminding everybody that you're going to die.
Yeah.
There's beauty and you're going to die. And you hold those both together in your hand at the same time. And maybe the beauty is sharper and better because you're going to die. Yeah. And maybe there's beauty in that you're going to die.
Yes. You know?
And like the still life pictures that would include a skull or something saying there's all this beauty, but life, yeah, is short. And
yeah. Yeah.
And the two exactly go together.
Yeah.
Would you want to read Softball, which was one of our favorite bittersweet, sure, poems, or another, yeah, one of yours?
Or if you have another,
yeah, if you have another favorite.
I'll read Softball. Have a lot of poems about getting old, obviously, you guys notice. Watching my husband play softball. 25 years, different towns, different bleachers. Minivan years when I chased toddlers, then years of our own cheering section. Now I sit alone, bottom spreading farther on the bench. Here in the pink dusk, it's easy to slip in time, both of us fresh and bright again, you as the sun in my eyes. But I wouldn't go back. So many good years and those darling wrinkles around your eyes. Watching you run, old man, still makes my heart beat faster, not always in a good way. You dive for a catch, and like a child holding a kite string, I thrill of two minds about the whipping wind. Please return intact. You have the same little boy excitement for each game, forgetting again you'll be sore for days. When you run, I see mine and never mine, like the sky. Walking back to the car, you clutching your favorite bat and I the blanket, we could be any two kids riding off into the sunset, our old familiar room and the landing pad of our mattress as good as any dazzling horizon to me and as warm.
I love that one. Yeah. And it just feels like you somehow, in this very specific instance of watching a softball game, like it felt like a lesson in just recognizing the peace and the comfort of aging and recognizing what you love all the way, you know, and it just feels like something that is harder to articulate because the more obvious thing is the soreness or the not being able to run as fast. And it just, I felt like so much peace recognizing that kind of in the same way that people talk about the honeymoon stage of your marriage ending, like what you don't talk about is like what replaces that, which is just like this love that has a depth that like you weren't capable of recognizing when you were in the honeymoon stage, you know, but we don't really have a name for that. And so
we don't talk about it enough.
Yeah. And so it's easy to approach that with a lot of fear and resistance. And this felt like the same experience of recognizing there's something deeper and more beautiful and peaceful about moving through these stages of life.
It feels like to me that aging in particular might be one of the easiest ways we all have into dirty pain, because number one, we resist it very naturally.
That's right.
And number two, it's with us all the time and there's just absolutely no escaping it.
Yeah.
So totally. I loved your perspective on this. Even just the sort of the artistic element of looking at it this way, it makes me approach my own mortality somehow with more peace.
Oh, good.
So,
yeah.
That's good.
Would you want to talk about what, I would just be curious if you feel like poetry for you, maybe even personally, like, is there a way that poetry is actually healing? Like, is it helping you as the author and the poet to kind of work through some of that dirty pain?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, it goes back to just I don't feel like you can start feeling calm about something or decreasing your dirty pain till you are fully present with and acknowledging the hard parts. So I think it's just all about tell the truth. Tell the truth about the hard things, and then you can get to a place of healing. I think the same thing should happen in prayer. You know, so many times we think we're supposed to just only say nice things in prayer. But if you think about it, what kind of a relationship do you have with a friend if only you say nice things? Yeah. And they ask you how things are going and you say, it's all good. Yeah. Like suddenly you just have this shallow relationship. So I think in prayer, in the church, in our relationships, we have to tell the truth about the hard stuff.
Yeah.
So in poetry, I feel like it should tell the truth about the hard things.
Yeah.
And that frees you to tell the truth about the better things too.
Yeah. Maybe related to that, maybe we should read prayer language right now.
Okay.
Because I think that's sort of related to what you're just talking about.
This was the piece that you have in Wayfair this winter edition. We love this one.
Thank you so much, Zach Davis, for providing us with Wayfair.
We are so excited that this was
Wayfair
part of it.
So cool. Okay, yeah. Prayer language. We are to add est and f to every verb. A tradition left over from a time when the words meant dearest, love of my life. Now they are meant to make language holy, sacred, not secret, set apart like a Sabbath. Thou art. Apparently, I shouldn't love you the same way I love gelato or the call of a chickadee on a lonely afternoon, as if they weren't the same thing. At church, children and newcomers talk to you straight out, not yet suspecting how strange this sounds to us longtime worshipers. How exciting. Once they realize, they blush and stutter, adding letters indiscriminately. I'm done with it. It's like wearing boxing gloves for our thumb matches, God, and I won't have it. Thou art puts you in the sky somewhere, and the sky is only half the story. You are my hero and my nemesis and everything in between. You are my heartbeat and distant drums, my breath and the glamorous squabble of aspen and spruce on the mountainside. You abide like sequels of blockbusters, all of them with you in the title. Return of, revenge of. You are subject and object. Rain and blood, darling.
So can I ask about your own prayer practice? Do you, like, what do prayers look like for Darlene?
So I'm always working on it. It's a work in progress.
Yeah.
But I have decided that prayer isn't supposed to be just the formal stuff that you do on your knees. Yeah. So a lot of my best praying happens, you know, while I'm writing in my journal. A poem can be a prayer. You know, it's a response. It's a conversation I'm having, you know, with my fingers moving. It's talking that I do while I'm driving. You know, it's thinking through, it's talking to myself. I do have my little formal kneel down and say the things, but then I feel like I take the prayer with me and I get up and I lie down and I ponder and then I'll pull out my journal and, still working on it. Mm. I would love to have the kind of prayers that I hear some people have where they like have these back and forth conversations that go on all the time. I do sometimes feel that, but I'm trying to see lots of other of my activities as kinds of prayers.
In terms of that other side of prayer, when you do feel some sort of response, how does that come? How does that come for you?
It often comes through words that I think are my own thoughts. Sometimes I'll just be talking to myself and I'll think, oh, I recognize. Do you ever I'm sure in this podcast even hear yourself say something and say, oh, that came fresh just now. And I can't claim the generation of that. Yeah. And I think that's God speaking through you.
Yeah.
So, you know, you listen to what you say. T.S. Eliot talks about writers and he says, how do I know what I think till I see what I say?
Wow.
And I think the same happens with prayer. Like sometimes, how do I really know where I am till the words come out? And sometimes the words will come out and I'll say, wow, I didn't know I felt that. And I'll also think, those words didn't come from me.
Yeah.
You know,
and sometimes sounds like. Those words make it onto the page.
Yeah.
As well.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. And then I'll try to put it onto the page. I think the craft of putting something down and then revising it is also a way of being responsive to the Spirit and saying, no, I think that's not quite how things are.
Mm. Yeah.
And don't you think that's what God wants us to do? I mean, you look at the brother of Jared, and God could have, you know, he told him how to solve the problem with the no air thing. So then when he wants light, God doesn't say, and I know that too, because guess what? I'm pretty smart. He says, well, what do you think?
Yeah.
Mm. And he goes and lets him play around for a while. And who knows at what point he really steps in. Obviously, at the end, he does by touching the stones with his finger. Who knows? Maybe he was involved in the choosing of the rocks.
You know?
We don't know. But I think on the one hand, God's with us more than we think. But on the other hand, he lets us be alone for a little bit too, because he wants us to grow up and experiment, do some stuff.
I think that's right.
I think I also feel like sometimes you just have to clear away so many of the dirty pain thoughts that are swirling. And writing feels like such a good catharsis for that. Like just writing and writing, writing until there's nothing left. And then keep writing. And then it does feel like there's clarity that kind of distills.
That's a really good example. Yeah.
Yeah. That has definitely been my experience. And I just keep thinking about what you were saying about finding what's true, because when I think about, so journaling for me is a real spiritual practice that I feel like maybe that is the closest thing to prayer for me, daily. It's the way I have I feel the most connection. But I think that it's about what you said. I think it's because that helps me figure out what feels exactly true. It's like writing and writing until something pings and it's like, okay, there's the thing that feels really, that's the most pain right there.
Yeah.
And like, and there's something really transformative about being able to articulate the exact pain that I feel like in that moment, like as soon as it's articulated, it's transmuted. And I don't know if it's finally, like you're not resisting it anymore, but like there is something special, like something transcendent that happens when you can really articulate an exact
pain. Yeah.
Yeah.
That happened to me one time, one of my most memorable prayer moments. I was unhappily engaged before I was engaged to my husband.
Okay.
And I knew it was wrong. And I was telling myself, I probably need to break this off. But I spent a lot of time on my knees saying, God, just make this right. Just make this right. I can't like this. Mm-hmm. I can't deal with this. Can you just step in and fix it? And I spent a lot of time on my knees, but it wasn't until I finally said, okay. If it's wrong, you know, I'll do the things I need to do and I'll get out of it. And it wasn't until I could get to that point and say, I'm just scared of what people think. I'm scared of the money that's lost. I'm scared of, these are all the things. Okay, now I see. That's the real pain point. It's not that I don't think you exist because you haven't stepped in and fixed this. It's that I'm scared of what people think.
Yes.
And then at that moment, I felt God step in and, you know, figuratively put his arms around me and say, we can do this.
Yeah.
We can do this together. You know, we can, well, let's, what do we got to do?
Yeah.
And then move on.
Wow. I love that. I know that experience. Like, I know exactly what you mean.
Yeah. We've talked quite a bit about how pain and bittersweetness can make their way into poetry. I would like to talk about, what poetry itself can do for pain. We have a little quote here from Sigmund Freud that says, unexpressed emotions will never die. They are buried alive and will come forth later in yeah. uglier ways. I don't know if you want to talk about that now or if you want to do this reading.
I felt like this reading, I was like, yeah. I don't know if we can ask you to read this poem. Like this, there,
it's
this,
really,
there's so much pain in this poem, but I loved it because I felt like I could see that happening for you. Like, I wonder if just figuring out like the exact thing that was actually so scary about sending your son on a mission, like, I wonder if just that experience would have been healing all by itself, you know, even though he was gone already and like there was nothing you could fix for him. But it felt like we were watching you do that.
Go through the pain of that. Yeah. So what your question is, did the writing of the poem help me deal with that pain? Is that what you're asking?
Yeah.
I wouldn't say so.
Okay. Yeah.
I wouldn't say so. Writing of poems sometimes helps me with pain because it's pushing myself to get to a more true place, as we've talked about. In that case, the writing of the poem, like, it wasn't healing to me, but it was, I wanted to share the experience because I feel like we tell only the stories of things working out nicely.
Yeah.
And I just want to make people feel like it's safe and good for us as a community to talk about the hard things too.
Yeah.
It wasn't really a healing thing for me, but it was just a sharing thing.
So if you take it one step further though, and say, I've written this and shared it, and now that it's been shared, there's additional connection. Is there healing? Is there healing there?
Yeah, I hope so. I think so. I think because I have been touched that way. And haven't you?
Yeah.
When you recognize something, oh yeah. You read the thing and say, oh, someone else has been through that. Someone else who's, you know, pretty solid in the church says she had a miserable time sending her kid off on a mission. Or says she hates Mother's Day. Or says she, you know, her kids could never say that she doesn't complain. Or any of these things. Like, oh, that's me too. Then I see there's others like me. This is what the human existence is like. And I can still stay.
Yeah. And you feel like so much love. I mean, we should read the poem. But you feel... I just was imagining every situation where someone seems like the enemy, like someone is the problem. And it just would be so incredible to have a poem like this that kind of shines light on what this person who you're seeing as an object is actually experiencing, because you can't help but feel just like complete love. And if we could have that experience every time we showed up that way to a situation where there was conflict, it would dissipate so quickly because we would be able to see them through God's eyes, I guess, is really the experience.
And I like the idea of putting ourselves in all of the characters of a poem or of a story. When we read the scriptures, how am I the prodigal son and how am I his brother and how am I God and how am I, you know, the other people? So in this poem, we're talking about the mission call, right? Is that the one we're talking about?
Yeah.
Is to think about not just the poor mother who's scared for her child, but the mothers of the potential mission companions he's going to have,
right?
Yeah. And also the two young men that would be involved or anyone else to put myself and show empathy for those people too.
Yeah.
Okay, 2 weeks after your mission call, you get angry. Your brother pushes you too hard. A wall gets punched. Ah, that old monster, rage, whom we've battled together the past 18 years. We both know by now that it will pass. I've learned to wait it out. But now before me is a vision of you 6 months from now, a small apartment somewhere strange, two young men imprisoned by the clock and rules with nowhere else to look but at themselves. I share all missionary mothers' fear of bad companions, having seen the pale, shell-shocked refugees of hate or abuse. But what if you are the one who will burden another, some other mother's boy? Have I failed you as mother, having failed to fix your human flaws? My own flaws as a human, as a mother, have broken my heart open to God. I have tried to teach you this, if nothing else. And so I send you into the fire, the hope that you'll break just barely enough. Break on the dotted line, please, Lord, leaving just strength enough to find the mender. So now I'm reading this and I'm remembering, yeah, it's so hard sending your kids off and you, like, getting back to the plan of salvation poem, like, you want to, when you send your kids off on a mission, they bring you in and let the moms say a little bit at their setting apart. And I always want to say, follow all the rules and, you know, because then you'll be blessed and you'll come home safe because, dang, I want you to come home, you know, please come home intact. But then I think, no, I don't want to take the roller coaster away from you, right? I hope that you have a really, really awful night where you are up all night on your knees weeping because you think you're completely alone in the world, because I know that's the place where you'll find God. And so I don't want to take that away from you, but don't, like, just break on the dotted line. Like, don't have it be so hard that you come, you know, come home broken, just broken enough,
yeah,
right?
Yeah. It's all the fears. Like, yeah. When I read this, something that resonates is sort of this underlying sense that maybe there, and I could be totally off here, but, like, maybe there was a years long struggle for you of wanting someone to be a different way than they were, yeah, and sort of like trying to reckon with the fact that we can't actually right. change people at the
and
end of the
wondering
day.
What's my responsibility as a mom? Was I supposed to have fixed this? Because I didn't. You know?
Have you come to much of a resolution there as your kids have?
Yeah,
grown
I mean,
up and
that's
departed?
The thing. That's the secret about becoming an older parent of older kids is you suddenly realize, oh, this is just the beginning of a long story of letting go. Yeah. I have no control. And you know what? I probably didn't have as much power as I thought I had those years when they were younger anyway, because they're just going to be who they are. Mm-hmm. But it's also a really joyful realization too, because it's like, I can't save my kids. Hey, they have a savior, mm-hmm. right? And all along, I thought it was me, yeah. but it's not. And I can't step in and do that. And I don't want to. And like, but it's also a letting go, like, I have to let you go have your little journey, and maybe it'll take you away from me. Maybe it'll take you away from God even for a while.
Yeah.
But that's what you having a savior means.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Love that.
Yeah. We probably better start wrapping up, but are there any other favorites that we haven't read that you'd like to do?
Yeah, I have one. I'd like, it's my last poem in this book that I want to read, because it's it ends on testimony.
Okay.
And I wanted to read it because it's a nice testimony poem.
Great.
Hold on. It's here in the pile somewhere, I think.
My pile's all out of order now.
Yeah.
While you're looking, can I ask you, how long, this is a very practical question, how long does it take you to write a poem?
So, I mean, when is one done? Like, I'll still be tweaking on it months and months later. And like, some of them, they're never just one draft and done. It's not like one and done. But some of them I'll just tweak it a little bit after, and others I'll keep coming back to it over time and over weeks. Yeah. And some, it's been a couple years, you know, it's waiting till I can just nail the thing.
But is there typically like a first draft in a sitting?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So I'll get a draft down, or I'll get like, maybe I don't have time to craft something into a draft yet. And so I'll, you know, I'll just free write and get the gist of it. I want this poem and I want it to do this. I want it to do that. I don't have time to do it now, and I'll set that aside.
Yeah.
Often I can get a draft done in a day, but they're messy and ugly and, you know, spend my own time. Okay, here it is. The mirrored ball never gets taken down. Yeah. I have this thing about disco. love a mirrored ball. It's like, I know there's so much more going on with the phenomenon of disco, but I love the idea of celebration with that mirrored ball. Okay. Each morning, God saunters over to me, shy wallflower, and boldly extends his hand. We dance. Sometimes I put on my flared skirt and polka at the picnic, reel at the barbecue. But some days I drift about in stained sweatpants, slumping against him like a 15-year-old with mean parents and a curfew. Still, every morning he shows up, jerks his head meaningfully towards the dance floor, and I keep reaching out my hand. Each night he returns me, singed and yawning, but sometimes summons me 3 hours later for the meteor shower fussy baby pajama hokey pokey. I will, hell yes. I will hail dance, drum circle, even as my heavy feet and heavy heart stumble, no, 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 with each systole, I will diastole back, yes, 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 tush, push, and boot scoot, yes to the twirls, yes, even to the heart-dropping dips, the chicken walk, holy Macarena.
I love that last.
That's my ending testimony in that book. So.
So great. It does really capture, I think, what you feel throughout the whole book. Just like it is, it just feels like spinning. It's just yeah. There's so many ups and downs. And sometimes it feels majestic and sometimes it feels like the hokey pokey and like it's all
kind of sweatpants. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Thank you so much.
Thank you,
that was so beautiful.
Thanks yeah. for having me come.
We're so grateful for you.
Okay, thanks so much for listening, and we really hope that you enjoyed that conversation with Darlene Young. A huge thanks, of course, to Darlene for coming on. Again, her new book of poetry, Here, is available right now on Amazon. And if Faith Matters content is resonating with you and you get a chance, we'd love for you to leave a review on Apple Podcasts or whatever platform you listen on. It really helps get the word out about Faith Matters, and we really appreciate the support. Thanks again for listening, and as always, you can check out more at faithmatters.org.